You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
KBOO.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. I was a mole in the ground. I'd root that mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Nations and our people that have been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poison in the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
Hots may we. Good morning. That was a mashup of the Old Mole Song and Stand Up, the Standing Rock Resistance Anthem. This is Nimi Pumol, Julian Ankeny, and I'll be your host this morning for this special Indigenous Peoples Day program of the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. On today's Indigenous Peoples Day show, first, I speak with Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White about the new student community garden and ITEC, or Indigenous Traditional Ecological Cultural Knowledge Learning Garden, on WSU Vancouver's 350-acre campus right across the river here from Portland. And we'll also be talking about the role of the gardens in revitalizing Indigenous first food and about the importance of honoring the Indigenous history of the peoples of the Lower Columbia Valley and their continuing connection to the land grant campuses capitalized by the 19th century Morrill Land Grant Act, rooted in the appropriation and alienation of more than 11 million acres of Indigenous lands. Then, Salmon Scam. In a continuation of the fish wars of the 1960s and 70s, a 1982 federal sting operation scapegoating and criminalized Columbia fisher people for diminishing salmon runs. This segment, which originally aired May 2023, we feature commentary from Salila Wayam, respected elder and organizer Lana Jack, and from Wanampum fishing rights activist David So Happy Jr., Bruce Jim, enrolled Warm Springs, and Wilbur Slawkish Jr., the hereditary chief of the Klickitat, who were convicted in federal court and spent years in prison for exercising their treaty-protected rights to fish in their usual and accustomed places. The segment also features commentary from defense attorney Tom Keith. The panel was organized by Lana Jack for SJ Con, WSU's annual Social and Environmental Justice Conference in April 2023. And finally, Indigenous Palestinian Solidarity. We hear excerpts from Professor Melanie Yazzie's wide-ranging reading and talk entitled Decolonization or Extinction, Reclaiming Our Humanity Through Our Love for the Earth. Speaking at WSU's Vancouver's April 2024 conference on extraction, militarism, and climate collapse, Yazzie, co-host of the Red Power Hour podcast, reprises her November 2023 speech at the March on Washington for Palestine. And she reads excerpts from The Red Deal and Red Nation Rising, works that consolidate insights from more than 25 Indigenous organizers and intellectuals with Red Nation Media Collective. Land Back, she explains, is the soundest environmental policy for a planet teetering on the brink of total ecological collapse. And now, first up, Robin Y and I speaking on WSU Vancouver's new Indigenous Learning Gardens and Student Community Gardens. My guest this Maywee is Robin White, Lakota Cheyenne activist and member of the Native American Community Advisory Board at WSU Vancouver, and working with the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice and Native American Programs. We've been working tirelessly to launch the gardens. The gardens would not only provide an excellent and sustainable source of fresh produce for food insecure students, but job opportunities for students, an event space for student organizations, and help build community and a sense of belonging on campus. We believe the responsibility of Indigenous knowledge holders is to share their place-based history and experiential knowledge for the benefit of seven generations of children into the future. We really aim to create pathways that center and uplift food sovereignty, sustainability, and community-centered regenerative food economies and infrastructures. The real goal of this work is to build on traditional ecological and also modern knowledge skill sets and networks while developing community-based solutions for food insecure students and the WSU community at large. Our main goal is to increase traditional ecological practices and expand the access to traditional Indigenous plants and foods for WSU students, their families, elders, and people with limited access to healthy food. Robin White, do you want to talk a little bit more about food sovereignty and the connections to Indigenous food justice?
We realize that the corporatocracy in this country has really controlled the food systems and take more and more of that power out of the people's hands. You know, this was particularly evident in the early days when they killed 100 million buffalo, started, you know, killing out the grasslands, which was some of the most food abundant places in the world. Just absolutely incredible. And how that has affected the political and the social and economic values of the Plains people, and really helped put them into the position of not being able to fight back and be prisoners in their own lands. They're doing that, of course, with fish now. We have to look at how these inability to think in watersheds versus these boundaries that white people make up and change every time it's convenient for them, rather than the realities of watersheds. You know, this all is coming to head. And when we have the water shortages, when we're having climate collapse that is going, you know, we're already moving particularly Native communities off of the coast and inland. Businesses are being affected by this. The economy is being affected by it. Fires, smoke, all these things that are in that circle of life really go back to a lot of the problems we're having in the food system and transportation issues. We saw during COVID and during some of the economic times that, you know, this system is going to fail. We don't have the transportation system properly. We don't have the food system to where it's going to work in a long-term situation, particularly depending on international food systems and local transportation systems. We need to get a hold of these food systems on a community basis where we have control of the economic values of the labor and of the financial situations to where the corporatocracy and the banks don't have control over it, and to where we can actually feed ourselves within that system while reducing our energy footprints and while reducing the cost drastically and really making it economically viable within our communities to do these. And I think with the technology we have now and these systems and these gardens like we're trying at WSU and relating that education out into the public and really mixing the traditional ecological knowledge with the modern knowledge that we have and the modern technology, I think we can really make a difference in our communities and how that food system works. We certainly need to try, and we need to make sure that people understand what's at stake here. And I don't really think people do understand ultimately what's at stake here. We're finding out in ways that we don't want to find out, whether that's the drastic weather, droughts, fires, disease states that we not only in human disease states, but in animal and biodiversity disease states. These things are changing. We have to realize that water is an integral part of that. That's the pump that, you know, starts the whole system, keeps the system going. It's also the pump that brings acidic water and kills forests and lets bugs get into the weakened trees and starts the fire cycle and the acidity of the waters and the ocean and their inability to continue to make food and the extreme water temperatures that we don't know that the total devastation that it's going to do, but we're going to find out. So this on the surface seems like a little program to feed a few people that aren't getting enough food, and that in itself is problematic, as I think it's over 60% of the students at WSU Vancouver are lacking in food, and many of the faculty don't have the money to either buy food or parking or other things. I think we need to look at this in a larger view of where our priorities lie. And do they lie in feeding people and making sure that people are healthy, particularly younger people? Or do we abandon all these people? When I say the percentage of food underprivileged people at 60%, it may be 30 or 40%. However, when you're forced to eat food of the corporatocracy, and a lot of that food, you know, is being made by chemical corporations and chemical-related agricultural corporations, which are basically one of the same, that your quality of life and the quality of that food is killing us, and that it brings on a larger disease state and also increases our medical costs, our basic living costs. So, you know, you can add another 20% of people that are maybe eating, but eating to die because of what they're eating. So, you know, we have to look at that in the larger picture. And that's kind of, I think, what we're trying to do at the university and with the gardens.
A huge thank you to Robin White, a Coda Cheyenne activist. And this is Julian Ankeny for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Pour les sketchs, wabinito. Namah Seet Lai Jadim Del Bidowsin Eskimodamus and Egnigam Minjasin.
Thoughts may we? Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. I'm Mimi Pumol, Julian Ankeny, your host for this special Indigenous Peoples Day program for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Emma Stevens singing the Beatles song, Blackbird, in Mi'kmaq. Before that, you heard Lakota, Cheyenne Mole, Robin White, and I talking about WSU Vancouver's new Indigenous Traditional Ecological Cultural Knowledge, or ITEC, garden. Up next, excerpts from an April 2023 panel on salmon scam and the fish wars of the 1960s and 70s. The panel begins with defense attorney Tom Heath.
A little over 35 years ago, I had the opportunity to represent David So Happy Sr. and Jr., Wilbur Flockish, Leroy Yocash, and Matt McConville in the tribal court retrial of the salmon scam. And it's a real privilege today to be listening to Bruce Jim, because I never got a chance to meet him. Our paths have never crossed, so it's really nice to be with him today and to listen to the great wisdom that Lana and her sister have about the real world implications of trying to live on the river and trying to keep lifestyles going in the face of what we on the other side of the river call progress. I've had a hard time looking back on that tribal court salmon scam era because of all the pain that was inflicted on river people. The So Happy family are members of the Wanapum Band of Columbia River Indians. The Wanapums never signed a treaty, but they've had a huge impact on the history of Indian people in the Pacific Northwest. So Happy v. Smith was an enormously important case that opened the door for the Bolt decision, which reaffirmed the rights of the tribal fishermen to have 50% of the harvest. So the name So Happy has been ringing through the corridors of power both here and in Washington, D.C., ever since 1968, when that court decision was handed down. David So Happy was an old-time Indian, nothing more and nothing less. He knew who he was. He knew why he was here. He said, my life is for the salmon, and when my work is done, I will move on. But there's a reason why 13 carloads of heavily armed federal and state agents came down to that little camp in June of 1981, kicked the door in at the So Happy's house, held Myra So Happy at the point of a gun while she dressed, and ransacked the house. And it had a lot to do with the history of the state of Washington. And I was born and raised in the state of Washington, and I remember the fish wars. I went to a small college just up the hill from a place called Frank's Landing, and you could almost smell the tear gas wafting up from that river. Cook's Landing and Frank's Landing were two of the epicenters of the Indian fishing rights dispute in the Pacific Northwest. And I think it's really ironic and interesting that Billy Frank, a Nisqually Indian from Frank's Landing, who was the best man at my wedding and became a very close friend, he talked me into representing David and these other fellows in tribal court. He is about to be enshrined in the U.S. Capitol, a statue of him as one of the two statues representing our state. When I knew Billy, any politician who saw him coming down the hall would run in the other direction just to get away from him. Because the fishing rights dispute that worked its way up to the Bolt decision only got more intense once the treaty rights were affirmed. And if you want to know why and what kind of climate it was, all you need to do is look at the Ninth Circuit Court decision as the treaty rights were on their way to the Supreme Court for the sixth time in that century. And what the court said was, what we're seeing in the Northwest is the most massive disobedience of federal law seen in this century, with the possible exception of certain busing cases in the South. And so that's the climate. I mean, people didn't just argue with each other. People pulled out guns and shot at Indian people who were trying to exercise their rights. And David and the other, Wilbur's father, Wilbur Slackish Sr. was our first witness in tribal court. I called him there because for a couple reasons. One is the Slackish name is the last name on the treaty of 1855. And Wilbur Jr. used to tell me it was because he was so reluctant to sign it. But Wilbur's father went off to war for this country. And when he came home, he took off his uniform and went down to the river to his scaffold to go fishing, and he got arrested. And that's the way it's been along the Columbia River. That's the way it's been during the, you know, since the dawn of statehood, suppressing, regulating, doing everything it could to keep Indians off the river was considered normal behavior. You know, you pull an Indian over with a tail light in his car and find some fish in his car, boom, off to jail he went for illegally fishing. It was really, it was a disgrace and an embarrassment to our state. And it's the darkest chapter in Washington state history. I think we need to keep that history alive, and we need to keep the spotlight on it. The treaties have been to the Supreme Court 8 times now. They went one more time under our current Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, who's a good guy. But policy in our state is driven by salmon steelhead user groups. You know, so whether it's the Department of Game or the Department of Fisheries, or they even now the National Marine Fisheries Service, those entities respond to the constituencies that they're there to serve. And they treat the resource like a pie-eating contest. Each year, they want to see how big of a slice each of the constituencies can get and how small of a slice they can keep the Indian people confined to. And it's just really ridiculous, particularly when you discover and learn, as I did, riding around the state of Washington in Billy Frank's old Chrysler, that the salmon isn't a lottery ticket. It isn't a toy. There's a spiritual quality about it. There's a reason why the creator sent the salmon back to the rivers for the Indian people who've lived there since time immemorial. That's why they have salmon feasts. That's why the people pray over it. I remember David telling me, if you take the first salmon to the longhouse, you pray over it, and the creator will return it to you 1,000-fold. That's what it was all about. And one of the great ironies of the salmon scam was the National Marine Fisheries Service responded to a request from the Washington State Department of Fisheries in the fall of 1981 to join with them and to go down and create an illegal fish buying operation. And their phase one was in that fall, and they just was basically a get acquainted session. Then they came again in the spring, and they suckered Bruce Jim into helping them out. And the phase three, they built a fish buying station at that sacred little village of Sulilo, because while nobody was looking, they'd snuck through a little amendment to a federal law called the Black Bass Lacey Act, and they created a dimension of it that had never existed before to allow federal court prosecution for violations of tribal law. Under the So Happy v. Smith decision, it would have been impossible that year to convict any of them in state court for a state court fishing violation. So one of the really real tragedies of that whole prosecution is that they ended up getting convicted in federal court of violating state law that they could not possibly have been convicted of in a state court prosecution. So, you know, I mean, that's one of the problems with trying to figure out how to put somebody in jail and then starting a sting operation before you have the law. On the day of the raid on Cook's Landing, a press release was issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service talking about this dangerous poacher who was wasting all the salmon. After his conviction in federal court in Los Angeles, the federal government prosecutor jumped up and asked for that he immediately be put in jail because there was about to be an armed uprising at Cook's Landing. And one of the reporters that was listening went and called the sheriff of Skamania County and tried to check out, you know, is the sheriff there? And the guy said, no, he's not here. He didn't come to work today. Oh, well, we heard there's going to be an uprising at Cook's Landing. And the guy that answered the phone said, gee, that's the first time I heard that. And so there was this constant, ongoing, orchestrated effort to paint David as the leader of a massive conspiracy. 106,000 pounds of fish. He was the lead, the ringleader of it. Bruce was, you know, right up there with him.
Yes, our treaty fishermen need to be exonerated. They were only exercising a right given by the Creator himself since the first dawn. So at this time, I would like to introduce Bruce Jim.
You know, that come from Columbia River, Mr. Lilo. You know, I come from a time of my grandfather's when there was abundance of salmon. Dry racks were full. Then came along the dam building days and the loss of village sites, burial grounds, access to fish. And sometimes you can't you can't see these things unless you actually lived through it, to hear the promises of the U.S. presidents standing under the dams that they built to the chiefs of the Columbia River. Don't worry, you'll have more fish coming back. And I will always remember those words on March 10th. Celilo flooded over. I was 13 years old at that time. I remember that day and how sick our old people got looking at this happening. It not only destroyed numerous villages, fishing sites, burial grounds, but most of all destroyed the spiritual strength of our people. This has, you know, when you start putting what the government has done, and they, you know, had eradication programs in places for their people to benefit from the buffalo, the wolves, the grizzly bears, coyotes, passenger prison, and recently a lamprey. And I often think if the shoe was on the other foot, what, and the tribes had that power, what would be thought and what would be done? You know, our people suffered a lot. And when you talk about the salmon scam and everything else, was all about special interest groups having more time to fish, more time to catch salmon, in order to get more opportunity for the fishermen to fish. They had to kind of start blocking and attacking the treaty rights of the people of the Columbia River. When we start looking at the special interest groups and how this all evolved, you had Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you had NOAA Fisheries, you had Oregon State Department of Fish and Game, you had Washington State Game, all get together and create an investigation, as they called salmon scam. Because somebody made a complaint of 25,000 fish that was missing. So we end up being investigated, and tribal people that was investigated. You know, today there's only four or five of us left from that whole investigation. No matter what the tribal people try to bring up, that Judge Tanner would deny it. And we never understood his reasoning of why he was like that and why he treated us in such a way. But it was because the government entity wanted to have their case and make their case to weaken the tribal sovereignty and tribal fishing or treaty rights. We were taken to a federal court system and convicted by a law that wasn't even enacted yet. 30 days after our conviction, that law came into effect, after our court case. In the Los Angeles Times, a week after we got out of court, a big writing in the paper, that 25,000 Mission fish was found below John Day Dam.
Thank you, Bruce. Chief Wilbur Slokish.
I would like to really hope that you can understand some of these things. And when Bruce talked about the special interest groups, they tend to forget they only have a license privilege because they have to buy a license from the state. We don't, because we reserved and retained those food gathering rights. But yet, when that longest welfare line in history, the Oregon Trail, came here, you know, they came with nothing. And all they wanted was a little piece of land to grow a crop to feed their people. And now we have the little piece of land from a thing called Doctrine of Discovery, authorizing us to do away with us. And I think the federal government's been trying to do that because they've been taking away a lot of our food source. These dams here down in this area here, I can only talk about Bonneville, John Day, and the Dalles, because that's what I know of. McNary and up there, that's different area. I don't have the knowledge of that. But they came and destroyed spawning beds in these dams. A big one there at John Day, they flooded out the spawning beds. And then they turn around and claim we're the ones that caused the missing salmon that were out there. That was not 25, but 40,000 fish. That's what they caused to start the investigation by Washington and Oregon, and insisting that NOAA Fisheries take away that. And then they didn't really come out and say what was causing those fish not to migrate up from Bonneville Dam to McNary Dam. But those aluminum plants were pouring fluorides into the river. And then they flooded the airways and the papers with propaganda that we were the ones that were making the fish decline. And when we went to the trial, Jack Tanner, the judge, he had always tell us when he'd recess, when he'd come out of there, and he'd say, "I know how to get you guys out of it, but I'm not going to tell you." Then he would laugh. He would laugh. He thought it was funny that they were prosecuting us. And we weren't tried as tribal citizens. We were tried as United States citizens. And when we manage these fisheries, there was millions of fish in this river, up to 30 million.
Thank you, Uncle.
Hello, my name's David Sohappy Jr. I've been on the trail with my father. I backed him up. We wanted to see you. All these words are passed down, father to son, all the unwritten laws. We catch our first salmon, we have a feast on it. We pray, we give thanks to the Munwitla, the creator. I've been doing that. I've been fishing since 1963, 60 years now. I've been fishing on this river, except 2 years when Jack Tanner threw me in jail, prison. He even threw us in prison because of rumors that Indians were buying guns up here. Went to Terminal Island, went to all the prisons in the West Coast, seems like. hardened criminals. I told those guys what I was there for. They couldn't believe me. I said, what's the government coming to? Were you fishing with fishing pole? I said, no. They were funny, you know. They were hardened criminals. They were there for bank robbery and in Lompoc, they put me in a guy doing 2 life consecutive terms. A lot of these things coming to the salmon now in the ocean, plastics, microplastics. That's bad for the fish. Cancer causes cancer. The Indians eat that fish, probably eating cancer too. So, but you find bad things in a lot of foods you eat nowadays. Like you don't have to be embalmed anymore when you pass away. It's just a joke, inside joke. Indians were never embalmed. We go return to Mother Nature, to Earth. I'll let my brother speak now. Andy, so happy. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Andy, so happy. My Indian name is Shmuhala. I feel kind of strange talking to TV. Usually I'm yelling at it. So my version of the salmon scam started in like 1938 when they flooded out our fishing area at Juneau Lake. We're dependent on that fish like the air we breathe, and that's in United States versus Winings in 1902. So when they flooded out that dam and they promised us home, they wanted us out of the gorge.
Was Hallucination doing Electric Powwow Drum. And before that, we were listening to a panel on salmon scam and the fish wars of the 1960s and 70s. An Indigenous Day shout out to Salila Wayam activist Lana Jack, who organized the panel. Next, we hear Melanie Yazzie's wide-ranging talk, Decolonization or Extinction? Reclaiming our humanity through our love for the earth.
This first section is called Resistance. The pandemic all but erased how the Wet'suwet'en Nation stood up to Canada and Coastal GasLink pipeline in early 2020, kicking off a year of intense resistance. In February, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police removed Wet'suwet'en and Gitxgan matriarchs from the Unist'ot'en camp by force. Police raided a healing center reconnecting Indigenous people to the land to help reverse the psychological and spiritual effects of ongoing genocide. Armed men forced their way through rows of red dresses set up by land defenders to honor the Indigenous women and girls who have gone missing or have been murdered on Canada's infamous Highway 16, known as the Highway of Tears in so-called British Columbia. The cops ignored the dresses, just like they have ignored the ongoing genocide against Indigenous women and girls. What mattered to them was their historic duty to clear Indigenous people from the land and make way for business. The Unist'ot'en camp, whose motto was heal the people, heal the land, stood in the way of the extractive economic giant that is Canada, a nation with a very public process to reconcile with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. The Wet'suwet'en matriarchs boldly declared that reconciliation is dead and called for a shutdown of the Canadian economy. Reconciliation is meaningless in a system where profits hold more sanctity than Indigenous life. Nearly $500 million worth of goods sat idle for several weeks in February 2020, disrupting supply chains for weeks, slowly bleeding the Canadian economy. It was the only language the settler state understood, money. Direct action focused on strategic choke points and coordinated with a mass mobilization of solidarity rallies, which forced the Canadian government to negotiate with Indigenous land defenders on terms it normally wouldn't consider. But more importantly, the Indigenous land defenders' demands became more focused. It wasn't just about reconciliation or stopping a pipeline. People get confused about what we want as Native people, Denzel Sutherland Wilson of the Gitxgan Nation said, referring to the eviction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline company from the lands of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. It's like, what do you want? Just land back. The crux of the so-called Indian problem in the Western Hemisphere hinges on this question. What do Indians want? For us, it's a larger social problem of underdevelopment. Colonialism has deprived Indigenous people and all people who are affected by it of the means to develop according to our needs, principles, and values. It begins with the land. We have been made Indians only because we have the most precious commodity to settler states, land. Vigilante, cop, and soldier often stand between us, our connections to the land, and justice. Land back strikes fear in the heart of the settler. But as we show here, it's the soundest environmental policy for a planet teetering on the brink of total ecological collapse. The path forward is simple. It's a decolonization or extinction, and that starts with land back. In 2019, the mainstream environmental movement, largely dominated by middle and upper class liberals of the global north, adopted as its symbolic leader a teenage Swedish girl, Greta, who crossed the Atlantic in a boat to the Americas. But we have our own heroes. Water protectors at Standing Rock ushered in a new era of militant land defense. They are the bellwethers of our generation. The year of the water protector, 2016, was also the hottest year on record and sparked a different kind of climate justice movement. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, herself a water protector, began her successful bid for Congress while in the prayer camps in Standing Rock. With Senator Ed Markey, she proposed a Green New Deal in 2019. Standing Rock, however, was part of a constellation of Indigenous-led uprisings across North America and the U.S.-occupied Pacific. Each movement rises against colonial and corporate extractive projects. But what's often downplayed is the revolutionary potential of what Indigenous resistance stands for: caretaking and creating just relations between human and other than human worlds on a planet thoroughly devastated by capitalism. The image of the water protector and the slogan, "Water is life," are catalysts of this generation's climate justice movement. Both are political positions grounded in decolonization, a project that isn't exclusively about the Indigenous. Indeed, anyone who walked through the gates of those prayer camps at Standing Rock, regardless of whether they were Indigenous or not, became a water protector. Each carried the embers of that revolutionary potential back to their home communities. Water protectors were on the front lines of distributing mutual aid to communities in need throughout the entire pandemic. Water protectors were in the streets of Seattle, Portland, Minneapolis, Albuquerque, and many other cities in the summer of 2020 as police stations burned and monuments to genocide collapsed. The state responds to water protectors, those who care for and defend life, with an endless barrage of batons, felonies, shackles, and chemical weapons. Next section, decolonization. In this era of catastrophic climate change, why is it easier for some to imagine the end of fossil fuels than the end of settler colonialism? To imagine green economies, carbon-free wind and solar energy, and electric bullet train utopias, but not the return of Indigenous lands? Why is it easier to imagine the end of the world, a zombie apocalypse, than the end of capitalism? It's not an either-or scenario. Ending settler colonialism and capitalism and returning Indigenous lands are all possible, and we argue necessary. The question of restoring Indigenous land to Indigenous people is thoroughly political, which means the theft of it was and is not inevitable or beyond our current capacities to resolve. The same goes for Black reparations, ending the hardening of the US border, defunding US imperialism, and stopping the continued exploitation of resources and labor in the global South by countries in the North. The issue is that accumulation-based societies don't like the answers we come up with because they are not quick technological fixes. They are not easy, Anishinaabeg scholar Leanne Beresamosake Simpson has said. 50 years ago, decolonization, which was nations freeing themselves from colonial rule, and land reform inspired global visions for a socialist future, advancing the class struggle further than it has ever gone before by raising the living standard of billions in the global South. Some Western socialists seem to have abandoned that future in favor of a technological pipe dream like mining asteroids, gene editing, and synthetic meat, without addressing the real problem of overconsumption in the global North, which is directly enabled by the dispossession of Indigenous and Black life and imperial wars in the global South. We need a revolution of values that recenters relationships to one another and to the earth over profits. The next section is a caretaking economy. A new green economy is the antithesis of what currently exists, a militarized extractive economy, what Lakotas call Oasichu Owe, the fat taker, the colonizer, the capitalist economy, or what activist Winona LaDuke calls Waitiko, the cannibal economy. If prisons, police, and the military are the caretakers of violence and agents of death, then educators, healthcare workers, counselors, water protectors, and land defenders are caretakers of peace and agents of life. A green economy should be born from and center the labor and needs of caretakers. Indigenous people, for example, are already working quote-unquote green jobs. They're just not getting paid for it or enjoying the protections employment offers for land, water, and treaty defense. Caretaking is often unrecognized work that is heavily gendered, severely criminalized, and never fairly compensated. The pay gaps between carceral and military workers, who are mostly men, and care workers, who are mostly women, makes this crystal clear. The climate justice movement needs to center the labor struggle of caretakers if it is to be successful. Caretakers can be powerful authors of a new economic system to replace capitalism through a caretaking economy. This caretaking economy is already in place. While making up only 5% of the world's population, Indigenous people protect 80% of the planet's biodiversity. Indigenous peoples and local communities who have distinct cultural and social ties to ancestral homelands and bioregions still caretake at least a quarter of the world's land. This includes places that are the literal lungs of the world, such as the Amazon rainforest and its veins, like the Missouri River Basin, areas facing existential threats of deforestation, damming, water contamination, oil and gas development, and mining. Indigenous people quite literally protect the land, air, and water we all need to live. Indigenous people understand the choice that confronts us. Here again, title of the talk, decolonization or extinction. We have unequivocally renewed our bonds with the earth, implementing Indigenous intellectual traditions in our movements for decolonization.
Was DJ Shrub doing Calling All Dancers. And now we return to the Red Nation's Melanie Yazzie speaking on decolonization or extinction.
There is no turning back. These bonds are sacred and will never be broken. This is why Indigenous water protectors and land defenders throughout the world are criminalized and assassinated on a daily basis. We have chosen life and we are therefore marked for death. Despite this grim reality, Indigenous people continue to caretake the land, even under threat of daily attack. The labor that Indigenous water protectors, land defenders, and treaty defenders perform is crucial to our species. We depend upon caretakers for both social and biological reproduction. Humanity would not exist without caretakers. But caretaking is labor. It takes work to plant crops. It takes work to hunt. It takes work to raise children. It takes work to clean homes. It takes work to break down a buffalo. It takes work to learn the properties of traditional medicines. Healing the planet is ultimately about creating infrastructures of caretaking that will replace infrastructures of capitalism. Capitalism is contrary to life. Caretaking promotes life. Caretaking is at the center of contemporary Indigenous movements for decolonization and liberation. We therefore look to these movements for guidance on building infrastructures of caretaking that have the potential to produce caretaking economies and caretaking jobs now and in the future. We also look to the infrastructure of caretaking that is currently emerging, where capitalist nation states have failed to save lives from COVID-19. Caretakers like parents, land defenders, and water protectors make up a huge percentage of workers who produce the social and material means by which we live, yet they are not paid. In a world being reshaped by a pandemic, caretakers have become the most important sector of workers, not only by saving people's lives, but also keeping whole families and communities afloat. Mutual aid networks populated by caretakers are proliferating, and they still are. The pandemic is ongoing. The monumental challenge we face is how to turn caretaking labor into life-affirming mass movements that can topple global capitalism once the emergency conditions of the pandemic shifts. Only when we are able to mount a real threat to the hegemony of global capitalism through such movements will we be able to heal the planet. Like the development of mass movements, affirming our relationship with the land is not optional if we wish to avoid extinction. This is not some mystical vision where we go out and hug trees. It is a serious agenda for decolonization that requires comprehensive land return programs and funding for mass Indigenous-led land restoration projects. Healthy reciprocity with the environment also depends upon Indigenous people having unrestricted access to land, unencumbered by colonial borders, and free of harassment from agents of the state. We cannot successfully wage class war until Indigenous land repatriation is taken seriously as a precursor to seizing the means of production more broadly. U.S. imperialism, the greatest threat to the future of the planet, will never end if land remains in the hands of settler capitalists, i.e. the ruling class. The collective future of us all depends on the ability of Indigenous caretakers to work with the land, restore its health, and reestablish balance in our relations. Part of the reason why I wanted to read this as a preface to reading the speech that I delivered at the November 4th National March on Washington, D.C. for Palestine, is because I think in this moment, it's incredibly important to understand what settler colonialism is. I was doxxed actually in December, so just about 4 months ago, I was viciously doxxed. I received death threats, and I was doxxed by what were obviously sort of right-wing white settlers for saying that Palestine, the question of Palestine, what's happening in Palestine is so central and it's so important to Native liberation here because it's also about land back. It's also about decolonization. And so I was saying we need to dismantle settler colonialism in the United States. Like this tells us this, what Israel is doing to Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank shows the entire world that settler colonialism only speaks the language of violence. It is an irredeemable project that needs to simply end. You cannot, as we say in the Red Deal, you cannot have an ethical relationship with land you stole, period. And so that being the case, there is much for Native people here to learn from the Palestinian struggle for land back, decolonization, and liberation. And, you know, we've been in the Red Nation, solidarity with Palestine has been central to our platform on Indigenous liberation and internationalism since it was formed. I myself went to Palestine in 2011 as part of a decolonial field school. I learned more in the 2 weeks I was in Palestine about the true nature of that sheer, just unadulterated violence of settler colonialism than I did even here in the US. So since we're almost at time, I'll just read this 3 minutes. I only have 3 minutes to deliver the most epic message of my lifetime. The media lied about how many people were there. It was at least 500,000 people at this march. I've never seen this kind of support for Palestine ever in the United States. This is also why repression is so intense right now against people like me or others who are speaking up for Palestine. Because the movement for decolonization is truly globalized, Palestine is a flashpoint, and we call it the tip of the spear right now for the movement for decolonization. Even now, when you use the terms decolonization and settler colonialism, it's starting to be criminalized People who are using that terminology are called terrorists now in the parlance of kind of the US right wing. And so there's a reason, right, why all of the censorship and the repression is happening. It's because our movements are growing and they're powerful. Today, we deliver a devastating blow to colonialism. As Indigenous people of Turtle Island, we proclaim that decolonization and land back are the only forms of justice for the crimes of settler colonialism. Native people have been here before. We know the entire history and future of Palestine because we have lived it. We endure the settler colonial project that calls itself the United States. We survived the elimination and removal of our ancestors. We are in our fifth century of resistance. We know that Palestine's future is a certain future because we are still here. Yet, Palestine represents an alternative path for the Native nations of Turtle Island. In this moment of our shared history, Palestine brings us closer than ever to the promise of true self-determination for all colonized people. We fulfill our ancestors' dreams by standing with Palestine today. Palestine is the tip of the spear that steers us all towards liberation. Settler colonialism holds nothing back, and yet it cannot defeat those whose cries for liberation resound louder than any bomb. Colonialism is failing, crumbling under the weight of its own conceit. The fort is breached and the wagons are burning. The end of colonialism nears because the end of colonialism is inevitable. The United States wages endless wars to maintain its position as the supreme settler colony of the world. Ours is the oldest struggle against US colonialism. Now is the chance to redeem your humanity, settlers of our stolen lands. Your support for Palestine obliges you to support our dreams of liberation, just as any support you show us obliges you to support Palestine. The end of US imperialism is the only solution for us, for Palestine, and for the world. Mark our words, the humble people of the earth have spoken. There is no place for colonialism on Mother Earth. For the earth to live, colonialism must die. A free Palestine frees the world to build a future of peace and equality. Today, we join our Palestinian relatives in a righteous struggle to author a new society. To our relatives in Gaza, we say, Keben Hitzil, together we are strong. May our message carry across the sea. Gaza, Gaza, you will see, Palestine will be free.
Tots Maywi, good morning. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You are listening to an April 2024 talk by Melanie Yazzie on decolonization or extinction, reclaiming our humanity through our love of the earth. I'm Nini Pumul, Julian Ankeny, and I've been your host today for this special Indigenous Peoples Day edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour. I want to thank my guest on today's show, Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White. And thanks also to Lana Jack for organizing the panel on Salmon Scam and the Fish Wars. Thanks also to Melanie Yazzie of the Red Power Hour podcast for their talk on Palestinian Indigenous solidarity. Today's Indigenous People Day show was produced by Desiree Hellegers with production assistance from Fran Michelle and from Aaron Thorne. Again, I'm Nini Pumul, Julian Ankeny, and we're going to play out today's show with A Tribe Called Red and Prolific the Rapper doing Black Snake Killers.
One family. If we don't stand, who will? On earth. The wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors. And death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tanks. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid, but I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see Kamimi La die in the mud. I looked up and told myself that enough's enough.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.